Well, our Advent series this year is built around the theme verse of Isaiah 9:6, where Isaiah says that when the Son comes, the government will be upon his shoulders, and he'll be called Wonderful God, which we looked at last week, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, which we'll look at this week, Everlasting Father, which Pastor Matt will share on next week, and then on the last message, Prince of Peace, I will be here and share that. In his book, The Knowledge of God, The Knowledge of the Holy, A.W. Tozer said this: what comes to our mind when we think about God is the most important thing about us. The history of mankind will probably show that no people has ever risen above its religion, and man's spiritual journey will positively demonstrate that no religion has ever been greater than its ideal of God. And that really is sort of the focus and the purpose of the text this morning. It takes place in 740 BC, and Israel is doing very well economically. There's peace in the land. It has the strongest military in the world at that day. But as is often the case with the nation of Israel, spiritually, it's not so good. Spiritually, there's a lot of apathy. The people are living according to the materialism of the day, and they're all caught up in all of that. And so on this day in 740 BC, Isaiah gets up in the morning, and he goes down and makes his coffee, and he sits down to read that day's edition of the Jerusalem Daily News. And he picks it up, and on the front page, in huge, bold, black letters, it says, King Uzziah has died. King Uzziah has died. A memorable year for the people of Israel that this king has died. But for Isaiah, it was more than just the year that King Uzziah died. It was also the year that his life personally was changed and transformed. In verse 1, he says that in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne. And God is trying to say to Isaiah that even though the king has died, the real king, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, is on the throne. And it doesn't change how we worship God or do we worship God that the King Uzziah has died. It matters, do we see the King of Kings and Lord of Lords on the throne? And it's so comforting for us to know that just as in that day, God was involved in his state of affairs for nations, but that he is also involved in our lives, in my life, and in your life. On a daily basis, he is there if we will look and see that he is upon the throne. God is showing Isaiah, and he's showing us through these words of Isaiah, that he is not only all-knowing, that he is not only sitting at the seat of power, but he is an all-powerful, almighty God with whom no one can compare. So if I were to ask you this morning, what is your view of God? When you think of God, when you read the scriptures and you see that word, God, Yahweh, Jehovah, whatever, and you look at that and you see it, what is your view? What's the first thing that comes to your mind? And as Tozer said, that is not an unimportant question, beloved. It's probably one of the most important questions that we will ever be asked. What is your view of God? Because you see, how we view God determines how we live our life. How we view God determines how we live our life. If I see God as some distant, that doesn't really care about me, doesn't even know I exist, I'm going to live my life like that. If I believe that God is a mean old guy sitting in the sky and just tabling, okay, bad Dan, good Dan, bad, 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 then I'm going to live my life that way. How we see God, how we view God, determines how we live our life. And Isaiah's life was changed that day. It changed for the rest of his life because he saw God as this mighty God. And it helps us to see. It helped Isaiah, but it helps us as we read Isaiah chapter 6 to see that God is a mighty God. And as we look at this passage, we see some of the things that Isaiah saw, some of the things that happened in his life as a result of seeing those things. And so when we read this, we see that we see God's might in his greatness. We see God's might in his greatness. Today, if we were using a more common term, I would say that we see God in his awesomeness. And in verses 1-4, Isaiah says, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory.' And then the foundations of the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke." We just saw that God is on the throne. God is on the throne. King Uzziah is dead, yes. But God is still on the throne. He is high and he is lifted up. He's greater than all other thrones together. The train of his robe filled the temple. I don't know if you've ever watched these the royal weddings from Britain. I'm not one of the ones that gets up at 3 o'clock in the morning so I can see it. I wait till I see it on the news or something. But did you ever notice that all of the brides wear these big, huge, long trains behind them? And Diana, who's passed away, was killed in a car accident. Her train had 4 people on it to help carry it as she walked up the aisle. Poor old Kate only had 2. Well, what does that mean? Why is that important? Well, you see, those trains are a symbol of royalty. That tells you that when they have those big, long trains that other people have to help them to lift it, they're seeing that these people are royalty. When you think about that, and you think that the train of the Lord filled the temple. Filled the temple. Angels were at his side to give glory to him. And these angels had 6 wings. And they covered their eyes and they covered their feet and they flew. They wanted to be, they were in the presence of the mighty God. And I think sometimes we make a mistake, beloved. When we think about God, I think that we sometimes think that God is above the best people. Yes, like, you know, we find some really holy, righteous person, and God is above them. But we're doing a disservice to God if we think like that. God's goodness is higher than that of any other human being. Any other human being. Even the best people are flawed people. All of us have our flaws. God's purity makes even these sinless angels blush and want to cover themselves from God. And then in verse 3, these powerful, powerful words, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the angels are saying, the seraphim are saying, that God is mighty. And not just mighty, but he is mightier than anything else that you can imagine. He is supremely holy. And then just to prove that, the thresholds of the temple actually begin to shake. And the temple is filled with smoke, adding to this sense of awesomeness and power that Isaiah was feeling. And this majesty And this awe that we feel in the presence of God leads to reverence. It leads to awe. And you just sit back and you go, wow. Wow. Yesterday was our 45th wedding anniversary. And as we talked last night, we talked so much because most of you know my background. You know that I was on the streets and I did drugs and alcohol and all those things. And we went through all the pre-marriage counseling. We weren't Christians, but we wanted to go through pre-marriage counseling with the pastor. And on the last night of our pre-marriage counseling, the pastor said this to us. If you insist on getting married, I will do the ceremony. But I am begging you, those were his words, I am begging you to cancel the wedding. And I said, you mean postpone? He said, no, I mean cancel. There is no way the two of you will ever remain married for any length of time. And he said, I'll only do the marriage if you insist upon it. And we insisted upon it. So he did it. And so far, it's only been 45 years. You say, well, he was wrong. No, he wasn't. He was right. What he didn't account for was Jesus coming into our lives. And so as we talked last night on the phone, we talked over and over and over about the awesomeness of God that took these two really, really messed up people and brought renewal to our lives, renewal to our hearts, renewal to our marriage and to our family. Friends, we see that, and we just see that awesomeness of God that keeps these two messed up people together for 45 years. We just go, God, you are so wonderful. You are so powerful. And I believe that true worship begins when we just stop for a moment. Just stop for a moment and take in the wonder and the power and the greatness of God. We just stop for a moment from our busy lives and just focus on who God is, what he's done in our lives. It begins when we catch a glimpse of this mighty God, even just a glimpse of this mighty God, of his awesomeness and his holiness. And so we see the might of God. We see the mighty God in his greatness. The other thing that Isaiah talks about, the next thing, really is kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum. Here he sees the greatness of God, his power, his might, his awesomeness. On this side, he reminds us that when we see God's might, we see our unworthiness. We see God's might in the fact that we are unworthy. Now, I don't know about you. This is not at all what I would have expected Isaiah to do. I mean, he sees this might of God, the thresholds are shaking, the temple's filling with smoke, and the seraphim are flying around, but their hands and their feet, their heads and feet are covered. I would have expected him to say something like, cool. Man, this is neat. But he doesn't. Instead, what he says is this. Woe is me, for I am lost. For I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. He came, as one version says, he was undone. He saw God's might. He saw the worship of the seraphim. But he says, I saw myself. I saw that I'm a man of unclean lips, among a people of unclean lips. And so his first response, the first response of any person who's not completely holy, and then they confront or are exposed to the holiness of God, is this deep awareness of their own sin. They see God, but they also see themselves in a spiritual mirror that says, I am a sinner. I am a sinner. When the unholy confronts the holy, we become very, very conscious of our own sinfulness. I don't know about you, but this is what it was like for me. I had, again, lived on the streets, all that stuff, but I had gotten sober and clean, and I went to university, and I got a degree, and I graduated second in my class, and I became the youngest treatment supervisor ever hired by Saskatchewan Alcoholism Commission, all of those things. And so it gave me this false sense of security that I was okay. And it was like I had lived my life, and in different parts of my life, there were lights off. And I couldn't see in the dark, and I couldn't see what was in there. And then I became a Christian. April the 10th, 1980, I gave my life to Christ. And it's like almost immediately, not immediately, but pretty close, those lights started to go on in some of those rooms. And I saw what was in there. And I was aghast. How could I have thought that I was okay? How could I have thought the way that I was living my life was okay? Because all of a sudden, these lights start going on in my life. And now, all the darkness is gone. Increasingly gone, anyway. And all that's hidden is exposed. And probably most, if not all of us here today, have at least a small idea of what Isaiah felt. We think that we're doing okay. We go to church. We give money to the church. We serve in the church. All these things. And we think that we're doing okay. The problem is so often we're comparing ourselves to other people. I go to church more than so-and-so. I give more than so-and-so. I serve more than so-and-so. And we compare ourselves to other people. And whenever we compare ourselves to other people, I tell you what happens. We compare ourselves to the people that we don't think are doing it like us, as well as us. We compare ourselves to people that we think are falling short. And so we always come out on the top, at least in our minds. But what happens when we compare ourselves to God's standard of holiness? What happens then? When we do that, when we compare my holiness not to another person, I compare my Christian walk not to another person, but to the expectations and the desire of God, what happens is that all those walls of delusion begin to fall down. And I begin to see that I am not what I thought I was. I'm one of those all, when Paul says that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God in Romans 3:23, I'm one of those all. And I still am to this day. You see, if a person believes that they did the right things to get saved, then we have no awareness how deeply stained we really are. We must be undone, as Isaiah was, to be remade. The Holy Spirit has to wake us up to our sinfulness before we can truly see and truly respond to His grace. And so we see this God, and we see that He is indeed the mighty God in His greatness. We see it, yes, even in our how we fall short. In our unworthiness, we see Him even in that. But how do we reconcile those two things? How do I reconcile this awesome God, this great God, with my unworthiness? And Isaiah moves on, and he tells us this way in verses 6 and 7. He says, "Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, 'Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for.'" What is this? Is kind of weird. Why does he come and touch coals to his lips, to his mouth? I think part of the reason is that he was a prophet and he wanted to cleanse those words that came out of his mouth. But I think that there's another reason that he was burned with a coal. Was I think that he was kind of cauterizing the sin. My mom when she was younger, had a terrible problem. Her nose would bleed for no reason, and it would be very difficult to get it stopped. So I don't know if they still do it or not, but she went to the doctor and had the inside of her nose cauterized so that her nose wouldn't bleed anymore. And as long as she was alive, I don't know if she ever had another nosebleed. And it's this process of sealing a wound or destroying some abnormal or infected tissue with this heated instrument. And so the God cauterizes his lips, so to speak, and removes the impurity. So what he shares will be from God. Isaiah's guilt is taken away. But friends, I think we have to notice something else that happens here. Notice that God wants to cleanse his sin. He doesn't say, don't worry about it, Isaiah. We all sin. Let's have a laugh together. You know, no. He takes it seriously. And he tells Isaiah, I am not going to ignore your sin. I'm not going to sweep it under the carpet. He says, no, on the opposite, exactly the opposite, your sin is atoned for. In other words, your sin is paid for. Paid for in Jesus. Now, one of the things that I struggled with before I was a Christian was how in the world can that be? How could Isaiah have been atoned for hundreds of years before Jesus came? And what I wondered was the opposite. How can I be atoned for? How can I come to know Christ and to know God and to be saved when Jesus was hundreds of years, 2,000 years before me? How in the world can that be? It doesn't seem to make sense. But Christ, God, through Christ, is willing to save us on the basis of that price that was paid for us hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago. That's what his son came to do. When Jesus, who was the sinless Son of God, died on the cross, he paid the sins for you and for me. God's justice was satisfied. Our sin was punished, not on us, but on Jesus. And because of that, he is able to extend mercy on the basis of the fact that Christ paid this in our place. And the reason that we are called children of God, and hear me say this clearly, the reason that we are called children of God is not because we're so good. We're not called children of God because every last one of us were at the top of our class. Like we were the smartest, we were the brightest, we were the handsomest or most beautiful. We were no, that is not it at all. We are called children of God because Jesus died for our sin. And beloved, I urge us to never forget that, to never begin to think that I deserve what I have. And I've often said to Winnie, and I hope she doesn't take it literally, that if I ever become apathetic about what God has done for me, shoot me dead. But I'm hoping she knows I'm just exaggerating. I never want to get to that point where I say, God, you had no choice. You had to save me because I'm such a wonderful person. But when we look at God and we see that he's the mighty God, when we look at his greatness, but we also see it when we look at our unworthiness, but we also see it in this plan of God, this provision that he made for us. And then finally, in the final verses of this chapter, he says that we see God's might in his call. We see God's might in his call in our lives. And he says, and I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And then I said, here I am, send me. And then he goes on to share the message that he wants them to share. He wants him to share with the people. The Lord is looking for messengers. The Lord is looking for messengers. He's looking for it in Isaiah. But we have to understand that he's looking for it in us too. He's looking for people who have been transformed by his grace and made alive by his mercy. And as a result of that, we volunteer for ministry. We become what Paul called in Romans 12, 1, we become living sacrifices. I'm willing to sacrifice for you, God. Isaiah is now willing not to serve out of obligation, but out of gratitude and out of a desire to exalt God's glory. Isaiah wants to let the world know of the greatness of God. He wants to tell him, tell people about him. He's not focusing here on, you know, maybe if I go out there, I can sell a bunch of DVDs in my school of the prophets. Or you know what, if I go out there, then I can sell some CDs and DVDs of my school of financial ability, or of this, my school of healing, or my school of public speaking. That's not what he wants to do. He wants to go out and exalt God, to honor the one who is the most worthy of honor. But maybe you're amazed by something else too. I know I am. I'm certainly amazed at this passage, awed by this passage and this call on Isaiah's life. But there's something that, to be honest with you, is even more amazing and so unbelievable to me, is that God has also called me to be his messenger. And he's called you to be his messenger. Now, that doesn't mean that we all become prophets and we all become preachers and we all quit our jobs, you know, and become a pastor and only have to work an hour and a half a week. Well, Pastor Matt is 2 hours, but that's not what it means, beloved. It doesn't mean. What it means is this, that I'm called to be a messenger. And all that is that as I go about living my life on a daily basis, I want to be sure that my words and my actions and my life point people to the mighty God. You don't have to stand up here to do that. Every last one of us in this room is capable to do it, and it has the ability to do it. Why? Because of God's Spirit in us. So let me just share real quick some observations that I think we can take, some lessons from the text, so to speak. There's no better way to spend our life than for the mighty God's glory. I don't know of anything else that I'd want to do than what I do now. And that I do whether or not I'm a transitional pastor somewhere or not. I just want to exalt God and spend my life for his glory. Secondly, a view of who our mighty God is, we want to take personal holiness seriously. How we live our lives is important, very important. The things that we find ourselves involved in is incredibly important. The things that we watch on TV, the things that we do with our bodies, the things that we do in our minds, is so important, so much more important than I think we think it is. If we understand God's mercy and grace at all, then if we have any sense of God's holiness, then what we want to do is we want to cleanse our lives of anything that is not holy and is not of God. And then finally, as I said, we need to stop comparing ourselves to others and start measuring ourselves by the correct standard. When we measure our lives by God's standard, we see ourselves as we truly are. And I don't know about you, but that hurts. In fact, it's beyond that sometimes. It's incredibly painful. And if that was the end of the story, then I don't think many of us would be Christians. But when we do that, when we come before God and we say, God, when I compare myself to your standard, I'm a sinner. But the amazing thing about the gospel, amazing thing, it doesn't matter how long you're a Christian, it doesn't matter how long you've been a pastor or you've been a leader in your church, it doesn't matter. When we come to God and we admit that we're sinners and we turn to him and say, God, give me your mercy, though I don't deserve it, guess what happens? God does it. God gives us his mercy. He gives us his forgiveness. So we're not looking at ourselves so that we can show how terrible we are. We're looking so that we can have that light turned on and come to say and get God, please, please, give me your mercy. And he says, yes, I will.